When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to Bingetown TV. My name is Jim, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Paul and Luke. And today we continue our coverage of Hulu and FX's Shogun. Today we cover episode 5. But first, as always, a little Bingetown TV housekeeping. If you're listening from our Shogun feed and you're not familiar with our other podcast coverage, then we just want to remind you that we cover so many different shows, and we'd love to have you as a listener for those as well. We're currently covering Masters of the Air, Peacock's The Traitors, and Survivor. We've covered so much in the past, so much in the future. So what I'm trying to say, as always, is that we cover a lot of TV, and we want you all to come for the ride. All you have to do is search Bingetown TV on any of your favorite podcast apps, or check us out at BingetownTV.com. All right, Shogun, episode 5. Luke, Paul, let's just jump right into it.
We have officially hit the halfway point with episode 5, Broken to the Fist. Little salty about it, because I would love for this show to have 20 episodes. Like, just keep on going. But we're officially halfway, and I feel like so much has happened. If you look back on us, have only gone through 5 hours of TV. This show is masterful at using every second, every piece of dialogue to really convey their message, themes, whatever they're trying to do. It just feels like there's always a ton to talk to, so it's going to be fun to break this episode down. What I will say about the episode is, I have two things that I want to just air it out live to you guys, and you let me know if you also thought extra about what I'm about to say, because these might be my first pieces of criticism that I could definitely be talked out of. Nothing crazy, because I still loved this episode. This episode was actually amazing. I would say when I was looking on IMDb, the ratings usually the day after the episode comes out, the episodes are usually higher and they slowly lower. This one actually didn't start higher than the previous episode, so I think this one's going to settle down a little bit lower for the general audience compared to the last couple, which is fine. It's still going to be like a solid like 8.7 out of 10, which would be amazing on any other TV show. But the things that I'm referring to are, spoiler, Buntaro comes back. I feel like this is the first moment in this show where it felt like a TV show moment, that they did that fake out death. And I kind of question why they showed it in the way they did, because if this was part of the plan the whole time, totally fine. Make it dramatic, build it up for TV. But to have him kind of run away from like 25 samurai, that part felt a little weird to me, because it was just a shock fake out death. And I don't necessarily hate it, because Buntaro comes back and a lot of his scenes in this episode are incredible, specifically the dinner scene. But that was one of my pieces of criticisms. And also, I didn't think that the Council of Regents scene was written, or maybe it was like edited weird. It just felt like I wasn't understanding what the heck was going on. I've seen it twice. I've seen conversations about it, and it just wasn't as buttoned up as the writing for basically everything else. That's pretty much my only complaints. And I'll stop there to let you guys talk on it. But it's, again, not super big complaints, but I see you nodding your head, Jamie, like you kind of agree with a couple of those points.
So when it comes to Buntaro for episode 3, I don't know if you guys remember, but we talked about this, and I specifically said myself, there's no way he's coming back unless they want to go with that like cliche drama of Anjin versus Buntaro. I didn't think it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Like, I agree with you though, Luke. It just seems like one of those things where I don't know what big purpose he's going to have for the rest of the show, except for what he's doing right now with Mariko and JB. If he doesn't really have any other purpose, then I think they did it for that reason, just to add some drama to the show. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily needed. I don't really have that big of a problem with it, but the fact that I joked about it, calling it a cliche, and then it happened, that's just like a minus for me.
Yeah, very small.
Yeah, not huge. Not a huge deal.
Yeah, I think the way they explained it, you know, didn't make it terrible for me. It was funny though, because we were joking like, yeah, he's going to come back and then butt heads with John, but that's like actually what is happening now. Mm-hmm. So it's we thought of it like it would be a TV trope, but the way Torunaga kind of explains it, and he just kind of shows up with all of them, like from traveling back from Edo, saying he met up with other Ronin. So it wasn't just like he 1v30'd everybody.
Right.
So that makes it way better. And it took 20 days. Maybe it's just because I love his character, but yeah, what a piece of shit, right?
He's like, gonna be.
Well, that's what I was gonna say, dude.
I hate this guy.
We're gonna have a great conversation about him later, so I won't comment specifically on that. I think we're all kind of in agreement. It was a little weird, but just because this show hasn't done anything like that before this point, like drama for drama's sake, everything seemed a little different. But anyway, onto the positive notes and the things that I really took away from this episode before we start going through everything. I thought that this episode was so needed to show the dark sides of the Japanese culture, because basically through the first four episodes, we're glorifying everything to do with the Japanese rituals, customs, honorifics, all that stuff. And I'm all for it. I love it. It was incredible to see that through JB's eyes as he's learning and adapting to the culture. But they needed to show the fact that from an outsider's perspective, they really don't put too much value on life over honor. And like, that can be a problem. And just some of the things that they were going through here, like honor isn't the only thing that matters in life, and freedom is important to some degree for being people. So a lot of that was really questioned in this episode for the first time. And I thought that balanced out like the whole perspective, and it really brought everything into like a really good balance of just showing the audience, like, this isn't just going to be straight just glorifying Japan. So I like that they did that. And then also I love that the general public is starting to catch on an episode too late, because we were right on top of it, that Fuji is just the shit. Everything about Fuji. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm seeing tweets like Fuji's the soft MVP of the entire season so far. And I just love all the praise, because we were right on top of it, giving her flowers the second she came back into the story. So the more she keeps building, it's good that she's a fan favorite. But those were my takeaways. Like, it was still a great episode. And Torinaga, of course, just every time he just slays with his dialogue, and seeing his mind process strategy and like look through all these social facades, like everything that he does, it's just repetitive at this point, but he's always an all-star.
One thought I just had on Buntaro coming back was, I guess they kind of needed it, right, for John and Mariko to advance their relationship. Otherwise, it would have never gotten to that point. And then him coming back, adding the tension, I'm sure it will add to much more in the storyline. But that was just one other thing. Everything else you said, totally agree. It's almost the complete opposite philosophy we have, right? Like, Marco's saying, we live and we die. And ours is like, yeah, land of opportunity. Go live your dreams. You can do whatever you want here. Just like, go have fun while you live. That's like the whole point. So, yeah, complete culture shock there. So, absolutely loving this episode, like you're saying. I honestly didn't even see them as critiques. This was just steady, hitting the average mark every single time. It's just like 9 out of 10s. Yeah, I'm super hype for the second half. If this is already this strong without any introduction and build up and background, the second half, I feel like, it's just going to be
insane. Pedal the metal, baby.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if you're averaging an 8.5 to 9 out of 10 for your episodes, then you're doing pretty damn good. To me, honestly, I thought maybe it was the lower end of compared to the other episodes. In just certain ways, maybe I was thinking too much about the cliche of Buntaro coming back. I thought there was going to be a little bit more action on the fact that Torinaga's son, Nagakado, took action on his own. We talked about it. I was wondering if he was going to be in way more trouble than he was, even though the scene where Torinaga puts him in his place is amazing. Mm-hmm. I just thought maybe there would be a little bit more to that, but we'll get into that, because again, with the way how smart and intelligent he is, he just like maneuvers around everything to make it all make sense and work for him. I agree with you, Luke. I thought that the scene with the Regents was a little clunky. It's like they're there, they're disagreeing, then all of a sudden one leaves, the other one's coughing, and we don't even know why. And it was very clunky, I would say. I just don't really understand. Unless you just want to have a scene showing that they just all disagree on who to make the next regent. I get that, but Kiyama.
So wait, let me just pause you, because let's just do that right now, because
this is going to be
a case where we're going to just go through the two of the three Council of Regents scenes right away that you're talking about. We'll leave the last one, like what closed out the episode, for the end.
Right.
But let me just talk through that, and then I'll let you just continue, keep talking, so it makes a little bit more sense here to the audience, where we have the Council of Regents. We have the only four left because Torinaga has already resigned. So it's Ishido, the leader, Sugiyama, the rich guy, Ono, who has leprosy, and Kiyama, who's the greedy guy. The last two are the Catholics. So they're talking, what do we do now that Fujinaga, we can't vote to impeach him. He's already resigned. So now they're just discussing who the potential replacement is. We get some insight to the idea that Ishido is being verbal and explicit about the idea that we're not putting another Catholic on the council, because then it's going to be dominated by Catholicism. And that's just not what they're going to vote for. So luckily, he finds a middle ground with Ono, who when he offers up his cousin, and Ono being a Catholic, this is good. This means that they're all going to probably vote on someone that's going to be neutral, kind of a middle ground here. Who knows if that's going to play out, because I don't think they really came to a consensus. But having Ishido and Ono vote for, I think his name was Maeda, that's a good sign. I know Sugiyama protests like audibly, and then he starts coughing, and that's like, what the hell is going on there? And then randomly in the middle of the conversation, when we're transitioning from scene one to scene two, that's when like the box gets put down and Kiyama just bounces. And maybe Paul can clear it up for me and you, Jimmy, but I didn't really understand what's going on here. Somebody in the Discord or somebody on Twitter, reach out to us and explain it if we missed it. I just didn't know how to take this. It just felt a little sloppy, this writing, but I got the point. Like, everything kind of made sense. And also in these two scenes that we're going to just openly talk about, a box with Jozen's head was sent directly to Ishido. And this is all before Lady Ochiba shows up. So basically those two scenes, whatever else you want to bring up, we can just talk through.
Yeah. So it was Sugiyama that was saying, I don't want Ono's cousin, but then he was talking shit on him and didn't realize it was his cousin, right? That's how that went. Because yes. Then Ishido says that's his cousin. He's like, oh, well, damn, whatever. And they need a full consensus, right? That's always going to be the deal. So, like, for example, Tornaga, if they're going to get rid of him, they need all four of the other regents to agree. So if they're going to agree on the fifth regent, the fifth council member, all four have to agree. So at any time, if one of them says no, they're still basically shit out of luck. So at this point, I'm taking it like they still can't make a decision. And then obviously we get the end of the episode, which we'll talk about later, where the dynamic's going to be totally different now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my take on that whole thing was it was a little sloppy, but the whole point was that they just can't come to an agreement.
Right.
Yeah, I think it was done on purpose, because before everything was in line, everything was formal, there was like etiquette to follow. And now that, you know, Tornaga has derailed everything so much, it kind of just shows how much turbidity that is in all of their relationships now, that, you know, they were kind of all united for one cause, but now that's gone. Now they really are having a tough time to function. It was weird. It was jumping back and forth a lot. The way they talk about people is so funny, because it seems like they just dishonor them, but like,
say what they need to say. They speak their minds. They're just like, that guy's an ass.
Yeah, it's wild. The only other thing was the coughing at the end. Was it? I think that was Sugiyama. I don't know if that's just foreshadowing for later, be showing that he has sickness. I don't know if it's showing that, like, maybe Ishido's like slowly poisoning him over time and he's gonna kill him and then blame it on like the poor health of the coughing. But yeah, I don't think we were supposed to take anything away from that too much. I think that was just setting up a domino to fall later on.
I don't think he's gonna be against Sugiyama because he's the only other non-Catholic, but I agree that it is definitely something that's going to be they did it purposefully. Like, we're going to see something. He could just die off screen and it would be believable if they say like he had whatever, tuberculosis.
Back then you can literally have a cold.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, though.
Yeah, and the whole scenario is really interesting, because obviously all four of them want to agree and they want Tornaga off the council ASAP, but then they all know that whoever they decide is the fifth member is the fifth member. So they have to, as rash as they want to be to get Tornaga off the council, they all need to think about themselves and what's best for themselves. And that's why they can't come to this agreement, because this change is going to be lasting.
Right. Okay. So we'll pick back up with that towards the end. We'll jump back into the Izu regions and all the scenes that are going to play out here, and then we'll come back to Osaka. So the first scene is the direct aftermath of the end of episode 4, where we're seeing the bloody, gory bodies of Jozen and his men. And I was about to be really annoyed if the army that approached was actually Ishido's, like, right away. That wouldn't have felt right for me. But coincidentally, it was Torinaga showing up with his whole fiefdom worth of power, I guess, is how you could look at it. And it's awesome, because like this is just everybody centralizing in one spot. It really, to me, means they're going to probably keep Yabu in check, because what's he going to do when the whole army's there? So that's just like how we open. And it's and then I guess let's lump in everything up until before they go to JB's house. So this is going to just include Torunaga talking to Nagakato, which Jimmy, you already touched on that a little bit, but we can expand on that. And then just the entire stripping of his role as the leader of the artillery unit. And basically that's that, we can just leave it at that. So a couple of scenes of Torunaga reprimanding his son and really reconnecting with Mariko for like a second. So just this whole intro part.
Yeah. First thoughts, Torunaga in his armor. Oh my God. Looks so good on horseback too. Just like the silhouette with the sunrise behind him. It was awesome. And then, yeah, Buntaro on horseback right next to him. I feel like this was ruined just a little bit because in the beginning it was like previously on Shogun.
Yeah.
It showed a lot of Buntaro scenes and him leaving. And I was like, well,
yeah.
Now that's the first thing on my mind, and it's the first
shows
thing
have been doing that a lot, and I don't know if I've been noticing it more because we're podcasters the last 4 years and we're really paying attention because we know we're about to pod on a show and take notes and everything, but it's been pretty crazy in even major shows like this where they're like almost spoiling, like you said, Paul, reveals because they want to make sure you understand what's coming when it happens.
But recaps and trailers in this day and age are just toxic. Like, they are not good.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with B-Tom's take where he avoids watching any of it because it does give away too much, and it did here too.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And it's like they're catering to people that are just watching now and like not catching up from the beginning. And it's like, well, that's kind of a middle finger to us because the shock value of that scene completely goes out the window. Whatever. Mariko wasn't too happy about this scene either. She saw Buntaro and her face did not move. If anything, it got more upset.
Yeah, obviously. I'm saying obviously a lot lately. But we've been talking about this the last couple episodes where at least I have been wondering if Mariko really didn't like Buntaro. Like, we know that she wasn't happy with him. We know that she didn't really like him, but we couldn't tell because of like the Eightfold Fence and how honorable they always are. If it's full, like, I hate you, or if it's like, hey, this is duty that I'm your wife and yeah, I don't like you, but it's duty. Like, I couldn't always fully understand. Like, I couldn't tell how upset she was when he died and things like that. But in this episode, it's just like, yo, I hate this freaking guy. And we fully understand now. And there's some amazing scenes that come up when it brings that part up. But we've been talking about the acting, the facial expressions, and Mariko killed it here with her facial expressions because that obviously confirmed it when she saw him. It's like, oh, no, she does not like this guy.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because maybe they needed to also kill off Buntaro so it felt a little bit more morally correct for JP and Mariko to hook up in the little window that they had too as part of it. I don't know, but it's going to be more fun to talk about that when she gets into her whole mindset with just he's not even deserving of her hate is kind of like the right point that she gets across later, which is brutal. Like, that's an insane way to describe somebody. Did you have a specific comment on that, Paul, or do you want to keep going until we pick up with it later?
I was just going to bring up the Falcon Hunt so we can.
Yeah, definitely. Keep going.
Buntaro's piece of shitness later on in the episode because he's got plenty of them. But yeah, this, I was kind of waiting for this Falcon to come back into play because they made such a big point of it in our introduction to Torunaga and his son in episode one. So they're kind of using it as a prop, and he used it as a metaphor for Nagakato here, saying men are either go out and hunt for themselves or they wait for the bait. But more importantly, men can be broken. You can get them to do the bidding for you. He was saying, yeah, Nagakato, you were the one that got tricked to scold you. I'm taking away your little military branch, the cannons, which is just, I was so ready for more, Jimmy, after our conversation last time, like, where you're like, yeah, shit, he might kill his son. I was kind of expecting a little bit more than, you know, I'm taking away your toy.
So I think I agree. Like, it definitely felt like a slap on the wrist for what he did. But Torunaga was ready for war. Like, he's showing up with this army. He was ready for war either way. So I think it was premature for Nagakato to do all of this. But he did think, he even says later, like, yeah, this was an advantage almost. The fact that Omi convinced his son to do this, even though he did it for the wrong reasons. And Torunaga's a walking quote machine. He's like a philosopher. So everything he says is a lesson in some way. So his son still needs to learn. He got to the right answer, the son, but he didn't use the right equations to get there, basically. Like, he wasn't thinking about all this.
Last episode, I was asking you guys, is there any chance that Torunaga comes back and is happy about what happened?
Yeah.
And he kind of is, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's upset with his son for making the first move and starting the war. But he's like, hey, it was a good way to do it if you're going to do it. So
it's, I couldn't have been more wrong.
It's like, wild.
I'll just, yeah. I admit, like, I did not
Luke, you said the show would suck if he gave him a... But it's not the same way as what you were expecting, like, when you said the show would suck. Because, obviously... He really maneuvered this ridiculously, Torunaga. I mean, because he owns the hell out of Nagakado by saying, basically, you were tricked. And the joke was that we were saying last episode that it was obvious to us that there's trickery and scheming going on Omi's part. Maybe Kiku will get into that eventually if she comes back into play. But Torunaga was literally just like, us podcasters, he's like, yo, I'm pretty sure it was Omi who tricked the shit out of you, bro. Mm-hmm. He like knows exactly what happened. And then he goes, yeah, boo, there's reasons why you would like this too. I think it was Nagakado, but if you were the one, it would be because you want some extra time to figure out your shit with a Shido. And he's just figuring the whole thing out. And then when Yabu's like, yo, I'll discipline him, man. I'm really sorry. He's like, whoa, this is the right move. Mm-hmm. My son's an idiot. He literally says, my son's pretty much an idiot.
He was too stupid to come up with this plan. Yeah, that's
right.
So
he's
funny.
Not smart enough to figure this out. Omi, for what he did, is the one I'm going to praise. Yabu, screw you, just because I know what you're doing, bro. And Nagakado, you're the idiot who was tricked. It's crazy how he just finessed that whole thing. It was pretty beautifully done. Now, my whole thing, again, is like what we just said. It is kind of a slap on the wrist for Nagakado. I didn't really expect him to just be like, I guess it was the right move. Like, now they're going to come to us, and it's going to make the war easier and this and that. Like, my whole take was I thought Torunaga didn't think they were ready yet. Like, they were going to need more time to prepare. And that kind of goes to what I was going to say from the very start of these scenes. You said you were glad it wasn't Ishido showing up with his army. I am 100% in agreement with that. But I do think the timing is a little sketchy with them literally picking up the pieces of the guys that were blown to bits. And then, oh, here comes Torunaga just showing up. Even though we can just say, yeah, he was on his way. It's just like very like...
Yeah. No, me and Alki, like, we had a verbal conversation, like, while it was happening. Like, is this weird? Did this just happen? Has it been an hour, a day? Like, would it really take him a day or a week to clean up the bodies like that? It felt a little TV show timing, which, again, lump it in with the couple of things that I'll call questionable for this episode.
Right. But, yeah, otherwise, Nagakado got owned, but just not as much as I thought.
Yeah, and let's just, you kind of started the next scene with Torunaga and Yabu talking, and we'll just to summarize, like, we're not going over this scene without saying that Torunaga's drip was, like, the coolest thing ever with that freaking hat. Like, he just looked like Peter Pan mixed in Japan. Like, I don't know what the hell was going on, but that fucking hat was so funny. And I don't really know if there's anything worth bringing up, but I needed to talk about his outfit because the costume department has just been so good this season, so...
Well, we said it a million times, but Yabushigi's actor is so good. The way that Torunaga, like, slightly brings up, or perhaps it was your idea, and Yabu's just like, starts stuttering, like, I would never. I don't know what it is, but just his responses and timing is perfect. Because, like, you are under a lot of pressure every time you talk to somebody at the status of Torunaga. Like, you could mess up any sentence. So,
especially if you're scheming against him.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you kind of get the stuttering, but at the same time, he's being smart, and it was wild. I was not expecting Torunaga to praise Omi this much. He's like, discipline? Why would you discipline him? I'm telling him that he's got command of the cannons now, which, well, that happened so quickly for me.
And I want to re-say this again, because I brought it up for the first time on the last podcast. People praise Omi as a character having, like, depth and interesting pieces in the book. So I like that they kind of are expanding on this. Maybe it was coincidental that he gets praised because he was trying to backstab Torunaga, but at the same time, it's cool that these things are just randomly happening and just seeing how they all react, because, like, the power of political plays are just insane how they treat each other.
Yeah, and Yabu, Torunaga is seeing right through him, and I think making Omi have control of the cannons is just a full-on slight on Yabu, which we get to later when Omi says, I'll hand them over to you. And he's like, bro, I own these. I own them. Why would you be able to hand them over to me when they're mine in the first place? Which they're not. That's the whole point. Torinaga did that on purpose. And, you know, he's trying to bring some issues between the two of them too. But to your point, Paul, with the whole, they say whatever they want. I get that he's mad at Nagakato, but to call his own son an idiot pretty much in front of someone like Yabu is not something I would expect from these types of characters. So I was pretty surprised at that. But I mean, you know, I mean, a father calling his son an idiot, it's not anything new or anything, you know.
And he is. He is an idiot.
He's telling the truth.
Yeah. And then Yabu, we thought maybe this would be, I mean, maybe it was just me. I know you guys were kind of flirting with it, but I was like, I feel like he's going to have to make a decision. His back's against the wall. He's going to join the homies, right? But he's still fully scheming, and he's fully on the other side still.
I cannot believe it. I'm never going back. I don't care if he becomes a saint. Like, I'm done with Yabu. He's lost all my trust. I keep going back and forth, but he's definitely on the negative side of just of Torinaga.
But the end of this scene where, you know, they're ransacking this guy's home because they're still looking for the spy, he talks to his one-eyed...
The right-hand
like
soldier.
Man. Yeah, I don't know what to call him. I don't know what his rank would be.
Number two
with one eye. Says, like, go to Osaka and, like, patch things up with a Shido for when all this turns
patch?
To shit.
Patch?
Oh, nice. I think he says fix things, but patch would have been better. That'd be funny.
Yeah.
But he says that kind of loudly and right in front of Omi. So Omi picks up on that. He hears that, and he might scheme with that. But do you think, like, Yabu was doing that on purpose because he knows Omi's smart? So he's going to be like, I'm going to throw false information out there to make you act and then catch you on the counteract?
I don't think it goes that deep for Yabu. I think the people that he's around right now are people that are his trusted, like, advisors, because he's saying, you're right, go to Osaka, repair the whole relationship. And they're also talking about the elephant in the room being the spy that they've been mentioning for episodes. So I can't see Yabu being that strategically smart to try and, like, suss anything out by planning this fake information out there. I just think he was just raging because he got disrespected by Torinaga, and he's trying to turn it into an advantage when he's, like, comparing himself to Omi. Cause he's just, like, in this moment, just being a little buoyed, kind of.
Yeah. So my question to you guys is, Torinaga, he seems to always know what's good, and we know he has this spy. Was Yabu assuming that he knew what he knew because of the spy, and that's why he was raging again about the spy? I mean, Torinaga being able to just say, yo, it was either you or Omi that convinced my son to be an idiot. You know, the spy obviously could have known that Omi and Nagakato had sake together the night before the throwdown, or, you know, that Yabu has been talking to whoever, and that was a conversation that was brought up. You know, it seems like Torinaga is too smart, unless we're talking about he has this spy, and that's what Yabu was assuming, and that's why he was raging again.
I think it was a little of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Torinaga also says the orders that he received, that Yabu received from Osaka when Jozen was there, Torinaga recites them, and Yabu's like, oh, like, you see through everything clearly. So I think that could have been another trigger. As soon as Torinaga brought that up, he's like, no, this fucker's got a spy somewhere, because how the hell did he know about that? I think that set it off, too.
And technically, everyone knows why Jozen was there for Yabu and everyone else, pretty much. But actually, really, when you're Jozen and you're talking to Yabu, they were talking separate. And him saying to Yabu, yo, come to Osaka and pledge to us again, basically is admitting and saying out loud that he was with Ishido.
Mm-hmm.
It was a one-on-one conversation. The people weren't that far away, but, you know, that could be another point check for Torinaga pretty much just knowing the deal with Yabu. I mean, he's been knowing it, but it's just another one of those things where it's pretty much confirmed. So everything he does is keep the enemies close and slight them when you can.
It's going to be interesting when, if they actually march onto Izu and, like, they have to shell up here, because that's, like, the whole point. But if we're going to, are we good with those couple of scenes? We can switch over to John Blackthorne, who we haven't even mentioned yet this episode. Mm-hmm. Cool. I'm going to just talk through two quick scenes, and then we're going to talk to the dinner scene. Because the two quick scenes, I'm sure there's nothing really going on there, but they play out later. The first being when JB shows up to the house and basically puts the pheasant up and then gives the forbidden command, don't touch it or I kill you, or you're going to die, basically.
Right.
We'll talk about all that in detail when it comes up in Matters. And then the other quick one was, we found out earlier that Buntaro is being, I don't want to say sentenced, but in his head, it is sentenced to live in JB's house with Mariko so she can still serve Torunaga and be the translator. So you see him being a little bit of racist and like being all pissy for a second. And he's like, all right, tell Mariko, like, I'll be back for dinner. We'll leave those two scenes alone because this is where everything's going to play out. And this scene was amazing. Whatever I say about this episode, like, I lived for this scene. It was fucking incredible. Let's just open it up completely from everything to them sitting down and him having his shitty rabbit stew all the way up until JB passes out. So before the domestic abuse starts happening, before they both like kind of leave. So a bunch of things happen there. I don't know how you guys want to start this, but go ahead.
The first thing, Mariko and Fuji just foreshadow the whole night because they're eating alone. And Fuji's just like, we're cursed, aren't we? The two of us, this house is cursed. Yeah, totally. Because this whole night, the tension was insane. Like I couldn't imagine being Fuji or Mariko in either of these situations. And JB was trying to be like nice and gracious when he first met Buntaro. Like he bowed. He quickly got corrected and was told to call him Lord Toda instead of Buntaro. So, you know, that's another slap in the face right there. Yeah, him trying to serve the rabbit stew. I was like, this, now I'm getting secondhand embarrassment, Luke. You want to talk about that? That was bad. I was like, this is so brutal because he's talking about how it's like one of his country's signature dishes and rabbit stew, but he's like, yeah, we need to substitute a bunch of things and we don't have this and this. Yeah, that was, I felt pain watching that go down.
They all reject it, right?
Yeah. Mariko put it politely though, the way she says it's our loss. I was like, wow, that's a really good way of saying I'm a picky eater.
Yeah. From someone who eats natto and it's supposed to be freaking disgusting, but they can't even like taste the rabbit stew and give it a taste. Be nice. Give it a little taste.
So, but when they do start to actually like eat things though, this is where like the manliness, the contest started, right? Like the first thing, which I've known this forever, and I always love like thinking about the fact that like when you eat things, you're supposed to slurp. Like I always say that because I can't help it. And like when I'm eating cereal or soup, I do it here. And I'm just like, well, that's respectful in Japan or whatever. And it is so funny that they just like try and be louder. And it even comes up later when they finish the first thing of sake and they're just like, oh, like they're just like, that was so good. Like the whole sake thing was so freaking funny because like obviously the Japanese people in this time period, they're treating like alcohol like a delicacy. Like you don't get hammered. Like that would go against everything we've seen from their customs and being all you know, present and like being all professional and all that stuff. So of course, like the guy from Western Europe is going to be out drinking and like having these barbarian ways. And I didn't remember how much alcohol content is in sake. I was thinking that they were literally drinking like rum, vodka, whiskey, like 40%. But sake is like closer to 20%, or I think it was like 15 to like 20%, which is still way heavier than beer. But like, I thought he was like chugging liquor like that, but it's still like what they were drinking would get anybody hammered. But it was just so funny them going back and forth. Cause I was like, they gotta be done. And then they just kept pouring more. They
slurping
kept,
like, it down.
Fuji's face was like freaking. I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, dude, it was just such a funny laugh out loud scene.
Whenever they pan to Fuji, it's always amazing. Like, they're just slurping down the balls and just goes to Fuji and she's making the funniest face. Like, what the fuck is going on? She is such good comedy when she's definitely not trying to be, but it's so great. Yeah, I thought they were done too. And all of a sudden, Fuji's bringing out more bottles and was like, yo, if he asks for another one, tell him this is it. Like, he's not getting any more. This is ridiculous. And go throw the stew out in the ocean. They fucking hated that stew.
She really says get rid of that shit. And talking about like anxiety and secondhand embarrassment, whenever John said something to Mariko to translate to Buntaro, I was like, is she going to say it in this way? Like, because he's like, I don't need this wuss ass freaking cup. I got the big dog cup, you know, and he's throwing it. And, you know, that like actually was tame compared to how it went. Like, even as it gets closer and closer to the climax, where he's like, something we will definitely talk about in a little bit, because even Tornaga brings it up, but, oh, I understand that women are property, but you need to treat your wife better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she translates that, and I was like, oh shit.
I didn't think she was going to do it accurately either, yeah, but she did, and it was awesome, because I think she just likes JB so much that she respects him respecting her, I think, and it's just like a culture shock for her as well.
So yeah, something super that freaked me out was, as soon as John asked about how Buntaro escaped from Osaka, everything got like, oh shit. And Mariko even says, like, I apologize, this is what he asked for. Buntaro gives like the great response where it's like, heroism's dead and stories are for children or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then Fuji even jumps in and is like, oh, like the Anjin or Hadamoto. No, they still call him.
No, Anjin, she said, right? They still say Anjin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She was like, oh, the Anjin like speaks out of turn or disrespectfully. Maybe it's more common for them to boast. That was when the tension was crazy high. And Marco's response to John saying, listen, my husband's drunk and he's tired. He asked for a story. Tell him one, but choose your words. Yeah, choose your words really carefully. Mm-hmm. And John's like, no wartime story. It's like, God damn it, you didn't listen to her at all. You imitate a bow for some fucking reason. Well, I don't know why the fuck you did that. But Marco's probably like, wow, I'm in the presence of two fucking children right now. And this was obviously the most tense when this fucking bow gets out and John's saying he can't even fucking see. And the whole thing, I'm guessing, let's see if you guys agree, is if Mariko moved, that would be disrespectful to Buntaro, saying, oh, you would have missed and you would have hit me. So that's why she didn't move. Okay.
It was one of the coolest shots of this entire show so far, of just like how they followed the arrow. I thought it was badass because I knew they were going to show the post at some point and it was going to be directly accurate. Like, fuck yeah. It was worth doing that fake out death just for this singular moment. And even Mariko gets so many badass points of her just blinking and not flinching in the slow motion. She didn't even sweat it at all. That's also just, regardless of how she feels about him as a person, she knows he's wasted, whatever. He's not going to miss. He's like one of the best fighters out there. It's just so fucking cool. I was loving every second of that moment.
It was awesome. Right post or left post? Decide. Yeah. Make a decision. You know, yeah. And he's right post. And the other thing too is that, so for your point, Paul, if she moved, if she flinched, he could hurt her very badly. Like, I mean, we talk about domestic abuse coming up in a couple scenes from now. I mean, I don't know how bad he would let things go, but if she slights him bad enough, would he kill her? I don't know, but she obviously knows she can't freaking move. Mm-hmm. And it's a sad life to live. And this whole thing was probably, this entire scene was probably one of the best scenes in the entire show so far. So yes, it was worth bringing Buntaro back just to have this back and forth. I was laughing. I was anxious as hell. I was embarrassed. I was nervous to do. I was changing it every second with my emotions. But really quick, and I know we're going to talk about Fuji some more, but it was a very interesting conversation that Fuji and Mariko have before. You alluded to this, Luke, when Mariko's like, this sucks, so let's eat up, basically. Like, this is another reason why we should eat. I didn't really realize, I guess, and maybe it's because she's the niece and he's such an ass to her, so she knows who he is and how much of a dick he is. But I didn't really think it would be outwardly known that, like, Mariko hates Buntaro. She was, like, basically, like, sorry he's alive to Mariko.
Yeah. It is kind of weird that everybody just knows it. But if it's, like, that open, maybe it's just Fuji because they seem to be close. But, yeah, she did drop that line. And I was like, wow, that seems like you could get in a lot of trouble if the wrong dude hears that.
And there is that lady sitting there, you know, while they eat, whoever, I'm not sure, again, what the purpose is in their culture of that lady that was there. Maybe it's a maid or a servant or something, but there's ears there.
Buddha meet assassin, 100%.
The little birds are always listening.
I'm glad you brought that scene up because Fuji says then to Mariko, like, if you think the Anjin is in trouble, you would tell me, right? and Mariko was like, why would he be in trouble? So was that Fuji saying, I know that you and the engine hooked up, so that's why he would be in trouble? And Mariko's just still being like, what are you talking about?
I think she knows. Like, I'm completely reverting on my opinion from the last episode, but because it doesn't make sense to me how it really went down in hindsight, like how the fake talk conversation happened last episode when they're talking about it, like post bang. I felt that was weirdly done. It wasn't explicitly confirmed that Fuji knew, but it was like all the facial expressions and the way she was alluding to it. I don't know. I feel like it was a bad decision to make her know, because now I question a little bit of the writing there, but maybe it's just my misunderstanding of how close they are as whatever they would be.
That would be her aunt.
That would be her aunt-in-law. That would be her aunt-in-law. Yeah. So like maybe they're just super close and I just didn't, and I underestimated that.
Either way, it shows a lot, and it's, and we get that more when it comes to Fuji, because while she is disgusted by his stew or the fact that he's holding the pheasant to be rotten or all the sake he's drinking or all this crazy stuff where hilariously every time it pans over to her, she's like, Jesus Christ, what is this guy doing? Mm-hmm. She takes this shit very seriously. Like, whether she knows they bangedity banged or not, she's taking her role seriously, being like, I protect JB. Yeah. So if he's in trouble, you need to let me know. And I need to do something about it. And it obviously comes up more later, and it came up in the last episode, but I still can't fully decide if she's in on JB or if she's just really in on her duty. I loved when she clapped back at Buntaro saying that you're the courtesan for a freaking barbarian. And she's like, oh, I don't know what that is at all. I'm a courtesan for an Hatamoto.
Yeah,
that was amazing. Like, Fuji's just the freaking badass. But the end of this episode where he kind of like puts his hand on her and they have a little moment, I'm hoping that it eventually turns more into like a friendship and not just here's my duty when it comes to her.
Totally.
Well, I think they're there. Well, I think they're there now.
You think they're there already?
Yeah. She respected that he respected the gardener too. Like, that was an incredible moment. Well, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but yeah, I'm already on like it's... Fuji is Team JB.
And Fuji is obviously Team Mariko, because she's always ride or die for that. But this is when, the very end of this scene, Buntaro's making Mariko tell JB her backstory. And Fuji's just bawling, crying in the background while this is going on the whole time. In short, I'll just give this, and then if you guys have anything to add, Mariko is the daughter of the late Lord Akechi Jinsai. Her father's lord was Kurado-sama, who was the ruler of Japan before the Taiko. He was corrupt and murderous, and her father killed him for the rest of the realm.
Yes.
And her family was just hunted after that. And the craziest part of it all is that her father had to execute his wife and his children. He had performed the execution and then committed seppuku. And the only reason Mariko wasn't involved...
She was newly married. Yeah, she said, I was newly married, so I wasn't allowed to take part, and Buntaro wouldn't allow me to die. He forced me to live.
Gotcha.
Otherwise, Buntaro wouldn't have married her in the first place, because what happens directly after this part of the conversation is Mariko goes on to say that every year what she asks of her husband is to basically finish off the ending of her bloodline, and he says no every year. That's going to lead to a very interesting conversation, because... And this is actually what we were just discussing in the Discord for Bingetown, where what is the reason that Buntaro allows her to live? And how I view it, and you guys tell me what your take on this whole thing is that he actually cares and wants to love Mariko, but the fact that she would rather be dead and like not be with him, like his, and him denying the request is basically him saying like he cares about her to some level, and he's abusive and lashes out at her because she's kind of rejecting him in almost a way where she just doesn't prioritize their family over like trying to deal with the honor. I don't really know how to take it, because why would he not just, because he talks down on her all the time. So why would he not allow her to end her own life, and then he can get remarried and just move on if he didn't actually have true feelings for Mariko, which can play into the idea that maybe he will confront JB if he finds out they were sleeping together, because he is a little bit jealous. I don't know if I'm looking at it too high school drama-y, but like that's what I'm really getting at, is that Buntaro loves Mariko, but she doesn't return the favor. And now he's like punishing her, and it's punishing himself, and he's becoming spiteful and abusive. And that's where what I took from the whole conversation.
I took it as Buntaro, the way that he was calling her family like traitors, mm-hmm. that he wanted her to suffer because she came from this bloodline of traitors. So maybe they got married, just it was arranged, not like they had a say in it or anything. And it was like maybe just to join two houses. So maybe there wasn't too much. I was kind of taking it as there was not much love in the beginning. Like they just kind of got.
So his whole purpose in life is to make her suffer. Like that's what his whole relationship with her is based on. He just wants her to be in hell, basically.
Yeah, kind of. So, because she has a line later where she's like, he loves my hatred. My hatred is what.
He doesn't deserve it. I'm not giving him what he wants. But
yeah, I forget the term she used.
Yeah. Well, my question is, shouldn't he feel slighted if he is, if they are brought together and it wasn't like they're in love, it's just, hey, they're arranged. Wouldn't that be majorly a slight on him? Actually, no, I guess because he was married to her before it was known that the father did what he did, treason and everything. So technically when they got married, it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the entire family is disgraced. Now, someone like Buntaro definitely, I would think, would be like, shit, I'm married to a disgraced family. I don't know where I'm at on this. Like, I don't know if I think he loves her. I think that I might be on the side that I don't think he thinks she deserves to be able to take her own life because the family is so dishonorable. I don't know why. Again, this is all about the culture and the ideals and everything when it comes to honor and stuff. Like, if he doesn't like her and he hates her, like you're saying, Luke, why do you let her stick around, or why do you say she's not allowed to commit? I guess she wouldn't commit seppuku, but like, I guess commit suicide, kill herself. But I don't, I'm a little bit like tongue tied here because I really don't know which way to go because I really don't think he loves her.
My only other guess would be like, because he has that warrior mindset, like you fight for your leader, you die for your leader. The fact that Mariko's father, his father-in-law, just completely ignored that and turned and betrayed and killed his leader. Maybe Buntaro is like, that's like the worst act you could do. Like, I want to make sure that his only remaining daughter like lives in agony, or anguish is the term that John used. So
that makes him like Ramsay Bolton level of
terrorism,
in my opinion. If that's where we're going, and I'm not saying you're wrong, I'm not completely convinced, and I'm sure every time they interact going forward, I'm going to be thinking about this now and looking for it. But if that's really the case, and I didn't even put that into the realm of possibilities until you guys are bringing it up now, or at least Paul is bringing it up now. But yeah, like he's like Ramsay Joffrey. Like I want him to have the most horrible death ever if that's how he's actually thinking about this whole situation. But damn, like,
yeah,
holy shit. I mean, that's really what it is. Like, fuck.
I just don't know if I buy that he's in love with her just because, like, even when it comes to him talking to Fuji and he's like, oh, I have to live with the Anjin. It's bad enough that my wife has to live here too and blah, blah, blah. I don't even take it like he's worried they're going to cheat or he's worried his wife, who he loves, is going to be in the same house as another man. I take it like it's dishonorable, but this is my freaking wife. This is my property. She stays in my house.
Mm-hmm.
Me and her aren't going to stay in some other guy's house. I think it's all about that when it comes to him, which, yeah, makes him awful. But something that I want to bring up, and it is fast forwarding, so we'll jump back and forth, but I think it's a good time to bring it up. The one thing that Torunaga does say, she goes to Torunaga and she's obviously has wounds on her face, and he says, Buntaro can do what he pleases with his wife, but I just can't have my translator be hurt. Basically saying that he's fine with Buntaro beating her up, mm-hmm. which throughout this show, we've talked about how it's a long time ago and we hate these people for this kind of stuff. But part of Bentaro might be just how men in general felt, and we can't really antagonize him as much as we hate him for. We can't antagonize him within that world for certain thoughts. Now, he's already, to me, past that threshold. Like, we have JB saying this is ridiculous, F you to him. But just the thing about Torunaga being okay with it, kind of like, I don't know why they had him speak that on screen to us.
It is weird because it seems like Buntaro respects the honor in everything that he does. So I would think that he, even though he does blame the Saki for being the reason that he beat her, I don't think he wasn't like about to punish himself in that next scene because of the like actually beating her, which Torunaga would have allowed.
It was
because of the house. Yeah. So that kind of reinforces the idea that it wasn't out of reason for him to be able to do that to his property, quote unquote. Like,
yeah,
it is a weird way to think about it because I didn't get it.
And I meant to bring this up in the earlier episodes, and I didn't want to because I freaking hate it. Like, I hate talking about this kind of thing, but when he was just being a dick and we're like, he's a freaking dick, obviously in our brains, we know, yes, he's freaking awful. But just like Torunaga said, I mean, back then in the earlier episodes when he's just being like, hey, get out of my face, and he's saying like shit like that to her, that's probably not even like out of the realm of possibility for like general conduct for men. We logically know he's a dick, and this episode thankfully really like pushed him over the edge so we can outwardly just be like, this guy freaking sucks. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the Torunaga thing, saying like, you can do what you want to your wife, especially like saying it to,
it's weird, right?
The wife, like, to her face, that kind of, I don't like that. But I mean, you're not really supposed to not like Torunaga. You're supposed to love Torunaga. So
it's almost like Torunaga would never do it, but he knows that he has no place to comment on how another man treats his wife. It's just the way, I guess, that it was.
Nah, my boy Torunaga should take Buntaro and whoop his ass.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's talk through the domestic abuse scene happens, and then they go out into the courtyard, and JB has his pistol like ready to execute Buntaro, and I did not expect him to just put the sword on the ground and like accept his death. Essentially, I'm extremely happy that JB didn't pull the trigger. That would have felt like it would have been pretty bad for his character as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought at the end of the scene, and I could have been misreading this completely, I thought that was like a knowing moment for Buntaro that, okay, something's going on with JB and Mariko. And that's how I built my theory watching it the second time backwards from that idea that maybe he will care if JB and Mariko are hooking up. And then I don't know, like maybe if he does care for her in any level, then that's what it's all about, of him not letting her kill herself. This is all going to be questions that get answered in the next like episode or two when we get more Buntaro scenes, because I don't know how this is going to really play out.
There's a lot of stuff in this show that come based on what lens you're taking it. And we've talked about it from Yabu to Martine to Buntaro now, where to me, I don't take it that way at all. I still take it like, if he found out that they were cheating, it's not, I love you, why would you cheat on me? It's, you. That's my property. You have no right to her. I'm going to kill you. And my property dishonored me. So I still take it like it's all the problem, all of that bullshit.
That works.
Yeah, I didn't think about that because I was just thinking he's drunk, and when he's looking up at John walking away, it's just a look of hatred. But you're right, it could be a little clue because, you know, John maybe wouldn't act like that if he didn't have any interest for Mariko. I mean, maybe he would have, you know, he's a stand-up guy, English gentleman, but I don't know if he would have. So that's interesting you put that out there. I'm going to kind of be keeping my eye on Buntaro now, like going forward, just to see if he does have anything. But
yeah,
just,
that'll be something we talk about, I think, for the next podcast too. Yeah.
Definitely.
And it just makes everything even more so confusing because we just are talking about this piece of shit who's hitting his wife. And then 2 seconds later, oh, I dishonored your house. I don't deserve to live. You can execute me pretty much. It's just very
wild.
And yeah, it's just wild as hell. And it's even more wild if you're JB, who is freaking livid. He is out of his mind getting ready to kill this guy, and he has no idea what this guy is saying. I mean, he's saying, I'm sorry, I designed your house, I shouldn't have done it, it was the sake. And to JB, he's hearing nothing except sake, and he's like, sake, what the hell, sake? You know, and you know JB isn't going to execute somebody on his knees. Like, he wanted a fight, and it's probably good that JB didn't get a real fight, because who's going to beat Buntaro? But yeah, this entire beginning to end scene at the house is just, you could like write pages and pages on it. You could write books on it of all the different aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. Fuji holding the pistols was amazing. That was my last little bit.
All right, let's keep going. The next one's a quick scene, but an important scene where we get Miraji, the spy that's been in the background for almost every episode. Like, he's been around, like we called it out last episode too. He is actually an honored samurai that Torinaga loves and respects and wants him held secret. But what he tells Torinaga, the spy that is that Yabu's looking for a spy and he's ready to sacrifice himself because everybody's ready to die on the drop of a fucking dime, which is insane in this show. But of course, Torinaga says, find a scapegoat. Now we're going to get to the aftermath, the day after the drinking, when JB chases Mariko to have a conversation with the important piece that happens real quick, where he walks by the pheasant again and says, like, he just kind of ignores all the people because there's no translator there. And they take it as they can't get rid of the bird, even though it smells and there's flies and it's actually affecting things. So JB goes, meets Mariko on the side of the cliff, whatever it is. And we get the reveal that Fuji's dad's swords are actually not what they seemed. And it's not really honorable. It was more just a front that they put on to make sure that Fuji's headspace, like, they did it for Fuji, even though the father was a coward. He wasn't actually like a noble samurai. And that's important for a little bit later. And then, yeah. And then John returns home and then you find out that that thing he brushed off resulted in the death of the gardener. I'm really bad at pronouncing this guy's name. Yujiro. Yeah. So those three scenes, and when John starts freaking out. So like, there's a couple things there, whatever you guys want to talk about.
The John Mariko conversation, the biggest takeaway I got was from John's angle, which I totally understand where he's coming from. He's saying, I don't understand what you're doing. You want to die to avenge your father, but you want to live in anguish to spite your husband. Like, which is it? Like, what do you want to do? I can't figure you out. She's saying, like, oh, you wouldn't get it. And she also says, you know, freedom's all you ever live for. You'll never be free from yourself, which I was like, hey, John's burn was way better. I don't know if you can walk away after that one. But yeah, from where he's coming from, I'm like, same exact viewpoint. Like, you want to die, but you're living just to spite your husband, and you're not going to show him any anger or hatred or any. It's such a weird position, and it has a lot to do with just how Japan was in that time and the situation that she got placed in. Mm-hmm. But it's wild, and I have no idea how it's going to resolve. Like, you see,
well, it's going to resolve because she's going to want to live life with our boy.
I hope
she's going to fall in love.
Fairy tale ending.
You know, I don't know if they're actually going to give us the thing I said would be funny, where JB and Buntaro are actually throwing down over Mariko. I mean, I think that would be pretty extra cliche. I think Buntaro will just have to get out of the way somehow. Maybe he dies in another way or whatever, but I don't know. Maybe they'll throw down. But I did want to talk really quick about what we're talking about, Fuji's story and Mariko's backstory. I thought I had something with the
Me too.
Christian stuff. And
Me too, bro. R.I.P.
I really didn't expect, like, episode 4, we're like, they gave us some, I'm sure they'll just start, like, giving us some more through the season. They just, like, threw it right at us in this episode. Mm-hmm. They gave us the whole entire thing. They flirted with it in episode 4, and then they just threw it all there. And, I mean, I do think it's important to say, like, Mariko doesn't think that her dad is a traitor. She thinks
hero.
He did the right thing. She thinks he's a hero because it was what was best for Japan.
Yeah.
That's very important. And I almost took it like, I know that she wants to take her own life because that's the point. Everybody else died in her family from that act. But I also was thinking that she wants to somehow avenge it. Yeah, I don't know how you can, because the leader that he killed is obviously killed. I don't know. I mean, I thought that, you know, her being a fake Christian Catholic because You know, I thought that was something cool to weave in. We'll have to get more into her religion again at a later point, because it's really like majorly in the back burner since we met her early in the season. Like, yes, she is 100% always wearing that cross. And I feel like, I don't know if I'm noticing it more because we've been talking about it more or if it's more prominent, but this episode, it was definitely prominent the entire episode.
One thing I want to comment on about that backstory that I think the reason that they all lumped it in, and you're saying like they ran through it all in like one episode, basically, it works in parallel with the exact story that we see play out here with Yujiro. Like, he takes one for the team for the good of the village and ends up dying. It almost is like an exact replica with Yujiro's sacrifice being way like on a smaller scale than getting rid of the current Taiko or the previous emperor, whatever his title was. So I think that's like genius writing when you're thinking about like them showing it in real time and linking it back to Mariko's past.
Yeah, I agree.
A little microcosm of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just to touch on Yujiro real quick, on the second watch through, I'm looking and seeing him in the background, just looking, taking care of the garden while JB's hanging up the pheasant in the first scene. And then we get them later and he's like, a rock, without a good rock, a garden is just a place of growing. And it's like, yeah, whatever that means, but fuck yeah.
And then when JB fixes the rock after the earthquake, man,
dude,
tears, man, tears.
And I think to your point,
onions.
Fuji saw that and gained more respect for him because he respected Yujiro and realized what he did and everything. And, you know, Mariko just explains it right here. It was becoming a village problem, and we kind of saw that just a little bit. And because it went to Miraji, who is the head of the village, he said it has to be dealt with in-house. So that's why Yujiro kind of volunteered, because he's old and he was sick, apparently. So my question is, did Miraji, would he have delegated it the same way if he didn't have this conversation with Torunaga beforehand saying find a new spy? Or was this situation brought to him, he was like, all right, I can get a scapegoat out of this somehow and get somebody to kill themselves?
That was like the biggest conversation me, Alki, and Dave were having after watching the episode, so I'm really happy you brought it up. I think me and Alki landed on the side that it's basically was coincidental and convenient to just throw it onto Yujiro as being like, this was a sacrifice, not for just for the smell in the village, but also like low key for Torunaga and the army and the good of the good side of Japan. So I'm hoping it's that. Otherwise it really taints your view of them. Like, would he really have went out of his way to pick somebody, just kill them and then throw documents in their house? I don't know. I think it was more about the convenience of it all. And I'm just going to blissfully be happy with that answer.
I'm gonna headcanon that.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I like that a lot, because the way that Yujiro and Miraji, even the way that they would few interactions and scenes they had together, it seems like they were friends or friendly at least. So,
and if Torunaga is out here saying that Miraji is like a super honorable, respectful samurai, I just don't think like blind murder just to get away, just to trick Yabu, is like on the table. That doesn't seem like in character. So, but yeah, just to kind of link us to how we got to the scene and we can keep going through it, I just want to shout out JB's acting when he did return home and see that they killed Yujiro. Like, he was just like, you guys are fucking crazy. Like, this, it was just like a explosion of all these emotions. And this is what I was hinting at the top of this podcast, where I said they really need to show the dark side of the Japanese culture and all the customs. So just expertly done. I keep forgetting his name. What's his name, Jimmy? The actor?
Cosmo Jarvis.
Barney's Peaky Blinders. Yeah, so Cosmo is just like, I hope he gets so many jobs after this. Like, he proved that he can act with the A-listers any day of the week.
Cosmo Jarvis, phenomenal acting. Again, the fact that he's yelling and Fuji, they're both talking to each other and they don't know what each other are saying, but they obviously get it because of just like the emotions that are running. And when it comes to Fuji with her duty and honor, she is crying and she's saying, you don't have to worry about this. I'm going to take this. You told me, you said out loud, touch the pheasant, dead. And he touched the pheasant, he's dead. And it was really ominous and crazy. He's walking it through the village and he sees people crying. And he's like, what's going on? And then it's Fuji's like, he took the pheasant. He's like, oh, I don't give a shit. Oh, it's whatever. It's a pheasant, bro. Like, who cares? And then she says, like, he's dead. And the explosion is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then him going to Toronago and Mariko. Mariko said, no matter what, from now on, our conversations are going to be through other people. We're not talking anymore, right? So he's walking up to Mariko. She's only a translator now. And he's saying, I did my duty. Give me my ship. Give me my homies. And I'm freaking out, man. I want to get out of Japan. I cannot deal with this anymore. Toranaga, like, when I said his men are dead, and Toranaga probably knows and doesn't care, I'm there still. Like, yeah, Toranaga saying, like, I can't deal with this, is beneath me and all that kind of stuff. They're not friends.
Mm-hmm.
AB is an asset to him, and he's his prisoner. I hope that they will eventually be friends, and I think so. This is another thing that happens when the earthquake happens. JB and Nagakato, but JB is the first one that Toranaga sees when he opens his eyes after he's saved.
Mm-hmm.
JB, whether he's a good guy or he cares about Toranaga or both, he has been there for Toranaga left and right this entire show. So I really do think that the natural progression is going to be that they're friends and they equally respect each other, but it is not there right now.
I think this, like, last two scenes are JB pushing himself above the bar of respect and, like, friendship for both Toranaga and what we hinted at with Fuji. I think he is now as good as you can get for being a white guy in Japan for them. Like, I don't think Toranaga is ever going to really, like, disrespect him purposefully anymore, like, treat him like this was, I think, like, the final straw. How many times has JB saved Toranaga's life directly, let alone indirectly? Like, this is, he literally resuscitated him too. Like, if he was like a second too late and he didn't get that breath of oxygen and his brain's dead, boom, gone. Like, Nagakata wouldn't have done it himself. So this was such a powerful scene. And then to add on to it, not to add, like, humor to this moment, but when he does get Toranaga out of the ground and he goes that extra level of giving him the swords. And at this point, he knows the truth about the swords, but also Toranaga knows the truth about the swords. And he literally laughs out loud. And I think it was like almost an ironic laugh for thinking how this man who doesn't know anything about our culture is restoring my honor of giving me Japanese samurai swords. But they're a gift from how we faked the honor for Fuji. Like, it's almost like an ironic moment, but at the same time, it's like poetic. It's just like a great moment. Like, the writing of this show, man, like, it all comes together, themes at the right time. Like, when they show scenes it's so just, like, purposeful. And I'm just in love with this show. So even when I'm saying, like, this might be one of the, like, the bottom two of the season, like, of the five, like, it's still so superb, like, of television.
Oh, hell,
like, amazing, man. And go JB, dude. So, saving everybody's life.
Agree with everything you guys are saying, which is confusing because, like, the scene where Mariko is translating for him, Toranaga is saying, like, he will stop acting like a child. Like, I don't have time for this. And it seems that when he confronted with the question, like, I want my men, he just changes his subject. You know, you have shadows over you. Like, what's going on today? Like, doesn't respond. So I'm totally on the boat that Toranaga is still using John.
Mm-hmm.
But then,
yeah,
John is putting everything out there to go and save Toranaga, and it's just frustrating because I feel like it's not going to be a happy ending. I feel like
I don't know.
Like, but we were swimming in our underwear together like two episodes ago, buddy.
Oh, man, I taught you how to dive.
Yeah, let's go back to that.
A question for you guys is, like, once this whole rescue happens and they're looking at and they see the landslide heading to the village, was the army kind of commingled in that? Like, did the army take a huge hit? Like, that's what I was seeing,
so.
Right? Okay, because that is where you're gonna say this show might not have a happy ending. Like, we needed some losses on the good guy side because it seemed like everything was kind of working out. Like, we're training with the artillery, like, the council's all split. This is what kind of needed to happen, is them taking a huge hit in where they thought their home base was going to be for the next upcoming battle with Ishido. So this was like, this single scene did so much for the show. And I hope it didn't. I hope we get some more specifics about how much the army was actually impacted, because we couldn't tell. We were seeing, like, the aftermath of the slide into the village. But that's going to be important to know. Like, did they just lose half their army, or did just, like, a couple guys just die here and there?
It looked like there was army soldiers swimming in the yeah. dirt or in the you know. So I don't know how bad it was, but I'm assuming the way that they looked, and again, it did destroy the city or the village, but either way, it was a devastating hit. And not to like make a joke here, but I was watching the scene with JB, Mariko, and Torinaga, and how he changes the subject and he says there's a shadow over the two of you. I was like, Torinaga knows all, man. He looks at JB and he looks at Mariko. He's like, you guys banging?
I thought the same thing. I just didn't bring it up because I was like, I talked myself out of it, basically.
Yeah. My question for you guys, and I'm sure like with Blue-Eyed Samurai and a lot of the anime that you guys know that I don't, what would have happened to Torinaga if JB didn't give him his swords, if he would have lost his swords? Is this something that would have been like devastating, or is it I lost my swords?
I was taking it as he wasn't supposed to be seen without any. So,
I mean, Mariko was losing her shit. She was digging like she was trying to save a life when she was like, oh my God, his swords, his swords, where are they?
Dishonorable, I guess, for him. So she was trying to save his honor by like restoring him and everything. And I think that was John's whole move too. But no, I don't exactly know. I just think people
would
have been like,
death.
I think it's just there would be gossip. Be like, yo, did you see fucking Torinaga without steel? Like, you sure want to follow this guy?
Yeah. Like that's
how rumors start. Yeah.
What a wuss.
Here's my last comment before we go into our last scene. Okay. Well, we do have the whole reveal that that Miraji lies to Yabu and plants like what we kind of already talked through. So you guys can throw out a comment there if you want. But I just wanted to point out again how good the writing is that in, I think it was last episode, is JB and Mariko had the conversation about earthquakes and like why they build and tsunamis and stuff and like why they build the houses the way they did, which I knew Japan was famous for tsunamis and earthquakes and all that, but I never got a visualization of literally like this could happen at any time. Like a house can go down. Like it literally happened an episode later and it was more impactful because like this is part of their culture. This kind of thing just occurs because of the environment in Japan. So I thought that was really smart for them to plant that seed last episode. I thought there was no chance we were seeing another earthquake, or how are they going to make it relevant without it being like movie timing? But it actually worked really well here.
Yeah.
I mean, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was actually going to say that in the last scene when we talked about it.
But anything with the spy reveal?
Do you guys think that this is going to completely solve the issue for Yabu? Or do you?
No. He's not buying it. So which I think is valid. Like he shouldn't be buying it. That would kind of make him look pretty too stupid, I would say. Like he's saying this is too coincidental, basically.
Lucky for him, he was like, real lucky for him, he died yesterday. So I figured like, this is just buying more time. It's not solving the issue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So agreed. Let's go to the fucking scene that I've been so excited to talk about, because this came out of left freaking field for me. I did not see a back half villain getting established at this point that's going to really be a string puller of the council. And of course, I'm referring to the heir's mother, Lady Ochiba, who already has every bit of my attention. Just the way they did the cinematography of like her motif music in the background, like how they were shooting it, where she was clearly the one in power when she was talking to Ishida, which I did not expect. All of that was so like, was pretty damn hype. Like I think she's going to be the mastermind. Her plus Ishida seems like a more fun force to deal with than just Ishida himself, because like they have to deal with the whole Catholic council members as well. But if she's like the head of them, all that stuff becomes petty politics. And now we have a centralized force that's going to be going against Torinaga. I just think this was a really fun setup for the second half of the show, where I'm fucking all in on Lady Ishida so far from what we got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. She only got maybe like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And you can already tell like, oh shit, like she's a killer. Like she is going to be making some ruthless decisions. I feel like bodies are going to be dropping pretty quickly here. She even has a line where she says like, when will the council be restored? Forgive my impatience, but I fear for my son's future. And Ishida says like, if anyone attempted to harm him, I'll give my life. But he's already made a statement like, I will kill the heir and become the ruler before. So I don't know. I assume Lady Ochiba knows this, and the conversation that she's having with Ishida is just a facade right now. It's just a front that he's putting up because she knows his true intentions, and this is just a formality to have this polite conversation. So I'm expecting her to be, in my head, I have her as very smart and aware of the situation she's in.
And I know everybody loves our Game of Thrones references, but this is literally Cersei stepping into the role of Queen Regent now, is how right. I'm like kind of viewing it in my head, where she's just gonna, like, I don't think she's trying to say, all right, Ishida, we're gonna be allies. She is looking down, she's like, you guys are gonna do whatever I say going forward, and that's just kind of awesome.
I agree, but my question now for the both of you is, now that we know this, how do you take the whole scenario that she was in with Tornaga to start the season?
So I was thinking about that, and I hope I got this right, because it's been only been mentioned in the first episode. Lady Achiba, who our new villain is going to be, is her sister is married to Nagakado, is married to Tornaga's.
Oh, to Nor. Oh, okay.
Because the
okay.
whole idea was she was in Edo because her sister was about to give birth.
Was giving birth, right? Yeah. Right.
And maybe it's not Nagakado, maybe it's another one of his sons, but it's one of Tornaga's kids. I'm assuming it's Nagakado. No one else has really been mentioned, but. I mean, she does. She cares about her family, like, so she cares about her son Yaichiyo, the heir. So she probably does care about the sister.
But my question is, if she is going to talk to Ishido like that and say, "Throw politics out of here, I'm the boss," why did she allow it to be like a maneuver on Tornaga's side? Why didn't, or was it even like she wasn't even that aware of it? She was just there, and Tornaga used that. And they just assumed he was holding her captive, but really it was nothing. And that's why she didn't really fight it.
Tornaga had a line where he was like, I released Ochiba to return back to Osaka. Like, she asked me to return, and if I rejected, it would have caused more issues or whatever. So
right.
I don't think he was ever really holding her prisoner. I think he was just there. And yeah. the council was using it as like, oh, you're maneuvering against us. And even he himself was kind of like not admitting it, but was like, hey, maybe I am, maybe I'm not. Like, you don't
right.
want to make a move
I agree.
And find out about it. So I don't I think agree. He was ever like capturing her.
No. And from her perspective, I thought she felt safe because one of the first complaints she has is you guys let Tornaga basically escape from Osaka. So I think in her head, if they had the leverage of having Tornaga there, there was nothing to worry about. They had the mastermind right. on the other side. So.
She has a line real quick to Ishido saying, oh, I'm told my release from Edo was thanks to you and the council. I think that was completely just her buttering him up because it didn't have anything to do with it.
Right.
And Ishido immediately is just like, I'm so happy you returned. He doesn't say yes or no. He just is just like, yeah. yeah.
Do you think she actually wants to be queen regent, or does she want to be queen, empress or whatever? Does she want her son to take the throne? Is that actually her motivation?
I don't think we're going to hit Game of Thrones level where you can switch the genders like that. Like, you can't have
right,
a girl
so she's,
just randomly
so she's
doing
just
it. She
saying,
wants her son to be the guy.
Right. So if she wants her son, then wouldn't she want Tornaga to be good? Because he's the one who's trying to do everything to make the heir actually become...
She wouldn't be able to manipulate him, though, I feel like.
But I mean, why does he need to be manipulated? Because his whole purpose is, I promised to Taiko that I'm going to have the heir become of it when he comes of age, he's going to be the next ruler. I mean, she isn't the wife. So maybe she's not privy to that information because she wasn't there when he was dying. And when he said, you know, protect my son. But we know that Tornaga is fully just, I'm doing my duty and waiting for the heir to come of age. He's fully Ned Stark. And we would think that Ochiba, Lady Ochiba, would be on his side then, because if that's what she wants, but maybe she just doesn't know. I'm
you're
trying to express
great questions.
My,
yeah. No, you're asking great. I don't think we have enough context yet. It's just guesswork at this point. We need to see how she interacts with other people.
I was just going to say that, like, maybe she had something set up this whole time with other members of the council. Or something like that, and knew that Tornaga was too smart for her. So maybe that's why she was trying to get rid of him early. But definitely a lot to unpack. Like, I hope she gets a lot of screen time episode six.
Me too.
Because she was all on the screen, we just said, for like 2 minutes, and look at all the questions she's posed.
Yeah. So
obviously, key player.
And I hate to add on to this at the end. I know we've been going a little bit long here, but this is directly related to the earlier scene when the Josen head box showed up. We didn't even talk about who sent that. And I think this answer, this is, I mean, maybe, I don't know if it's obvious or not, but this is where I'm leaning towards is this is where I think Kiku comes into place. I think she's a spy for the council potentially. And that would make sense because Kiku was trying to manipulate Omi into causing a strife with Yabu and Torunaga. That would all fall in line with the council's agenda. And so her sending the box of Josen's head to Ishido to prepare them for war is also kind of flowing into their plan as well. So I think maybe since we already know who the spy was for Torunaga being Muraji, like I think Kiku could be the inside person for the council and then by extension, Lady Achiba.
Was this really, like, what she was doing, was it really in the council's favor, though? Because even Torunaga is saying, like, oh, like, we have the advantage now because they're going to have to attack us.
Well, yeah, but, like, Yabu in that moment thought that this was, like, so bad for Torunaga, so maybe she also thought that convincing Omi to push him into this position was also bad, because all it was doing is just forcing the war.
Gotcha.
So, I'm just guessing, like, this is still, I don't know, Jimmy, your theory town, what do you think? Is that, does that hold any weight?
No, I mean, I like that. My first thought was pretty surface level, and it was just Nagakato being the young kid doing what he, you know, oh, I just took the head from your number two, and here he is, just to throw it in his face. But Kiku, I just feel like she has to come back as a spy for someone, and it would make sense to be a Shido spy. Talking through it with, if everything about what she did with Omi makes sense, probably can't be done clearly at this point because, you know, she could say one thing, hope that he's going to do another, and then he does another thing, and then Nagakato does another thing, and then who knows what her actual motive was. But, you know, her motive could have fully been for the council, and then just going through the grapevine, it kind of got screwed up. So, yeah, I mean, I could see a lot of different things, and there's definitely not any problem with having that on the board, Luke.
As for who sent the head, I think it wouldn't have been Torunaga just because
I think it was Kevin Spacey, dude.
Kevin Spacey, nice. Yeah, what's in the box? I figured it was Nagakato as well, just because it would have seemed a little bit dishonorable, like salt in the wound, to send a head in a box home after just starting the war. It doesn't seem something like Torunaga would do, but I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they're posing that question on purpose.
And my thought would be, hopefully, it was something that happened that Torunaga didn't know happened. It happened before he got there, and it would have been Nagakato almost gloating, but who knows? I don't know if we're going to get too much of that, but it was a crazy scene, and I hope I didn't just spoil 7 for the world, but I mean, 1997, I think we're good. I think we're good with the statute of limitations on spoilers here.
I just spoiled season 5 or 6 of Game of Thrones. So there you go. That's a little
that's
bit more
all right.
Recent. But dude, this show fucking rocks. I'm like hype right now. It's so fun to talk about. I look forward to Shogun Tuesday every freaking week. And then I just walk away from these podcasts so satisfied. Like everything, all the writing is so good. I even like this episode almost as much as the other ones now that we talk through it. Like maybe this is a better episode. It's just so fun, dude. This show is awesome.
I find myself on like Saturdays or Sundays be like, oh shit, I wish we recorded now because I just thought of something else. Like I think about like we were watch it, recording on it, and I still think about it like the rest of the week.
Oh yeah. That's why I make those YouTube videos, because I just have to spit it out.
Yeah.
And think of something else. Thank God you said that too, because we didn't mention the cool ass moment when Buntaro catches the fly. That adds to his like badassery too. Just had to bring that up. He can fight. That's the only thing I'll ever say positive about him. He's a badass.
Yeah.
He's like an anime level fighter with like that bow and arrow scene, the fly catching. Like he's a badass, but he's also the worst person alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Worst person alive. And he's back for the cliche-ness. We'll see how far, what his purpose is. But I really do think that whole scene when they're at his house, the whole dinner/drinking scene was just one of the best scenes in the entire series so far. And that's why we talked about it so much. So if you guys don't have anything else, we can hit that outro. So if you guys like what you heard, check us out at BingeTownTV.com. We want you guys to jump on our Discord. We are having a blast on this Discord. Shogun talk, what should you watch next talk, any TV show, but especially right now, Shogun. Shout out to Meryl. talking to us lately about Shogun right now. It's just, we're having a great time. So if you guys want to check us out on the Discord and join our community, that link is in the description of the YouTube and of the podcast. Otherwise, hit us up at BingeTownTV.com or at BingeTownTV on any of your favorite podcast apps. We cover so much. We have covered so much, and we will cover so much. So we're sure there's something you'll love. Once again, we are BingeTownTV, and Luke, Paul, Shogun, it's yesterday.
Tomorrow is tomorrow. Wednesday. Shogun was today.
I hate you.
Shogun's next Tuesday, too. Thanks so much for listening.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.